Okay. Fleming v. Livingston County, 11-21-70. Mr. Stegall.
Thank you, Judge Williams, Judge Mannion, Jessica Deal. This is the first time. I've been a few times in the Northern District, but I have not had the pleasure. This is a Section 1980, another police case, but this is in the false arrest context of Section 1983. It occurred in Flanagan, Illinois, a town of 1,700 people, about just off of Interstate 55 near Pontiac in Livingston County. Basically, the legal issue before you, Judge McDade found, was that there was tribal issues of fact on whether the defendant, Deputy Turner, had probable cause to arrest the plaintiff, but that qualified immunity, that Turner had qualified immunity. That is a non sequitur, that the cases suggest strongly that you, and certainly Johnson case, that you don't have a court of appeals jurisdiction to decide tribal issue, qualified immunity on tribal issues of fact, would have to apply to a district court. So I think that unless there's some very unusual circumstances where you've got some new knock and announce rule or something like that, changes in the law, you're going to have these are fact-intensive questions. The judge has to wait the jury, and all the machinations from the Saucier case, that whether they merge or not, Supreme Court's now said the Court of Appeals and district courts may look at this qualified immunity test as it fits the case, which I think clearly this comes down to. Was there tribal issues of fact a probable cause? I don't see how that's different with what a reasonable police officer would believe.
You do agree that this court would have jurisdiction to find probable cause on appeal de novo?
Yes, that's why I'm going into the facts right now.
Okay.
I let in with the law. I think the facts, this is a fact-intensive appeal. You're looking at it de novo about his ruling that there was a tribal issue of fact on probable cause. Certainly you could say de novo, no, there isn't. Well, then the error of law I'm talking about is irrelevant then. So the facts... it's an intruder is best described in the home of the Troxels. This occurred in a four-block area, and this is one of those instances where the technology and advances we've got helped a lot. I have a Google map that's an S4 and a satellite view and then also a map view, and then at S5 are photos of the Flemings. Roger Fleming's house.
Let me just, before you get into that, so you're basically saying that we need to apply the same test for qualified immunity as a probable cause? Don't we look at it a little differently to see that, you know, the conduct was so egregious no reasonable person could have believed it didn't violate clearly established rights?
Well, that's the phrase, but in this case, the question is, was Deputy Turner lying? And if he's lying,
your point is because he lied, it would violate clearly established
right, and that needs to be decided, I think, on these facts by a jury. And well, let's put it this way: if you have facts suggesting that, which we don't see much in the cases, that he's testifying about probable cause, which the literature says occurs, we don't hear much about, then well, he can't have qualified immunity because no reasonable officer could believe it's all right to lie.
Your theory is, and it comes through in the briefs, especially the reply brief, that he is just lying about the entire situation.
Yes.
But did that bring a malicious prosecution claim?
Well, that's under your law. We can't do that. He was incarcerated for 47 days on the arrest, so there's a substantial injury there. So that we don't have the state malicious prosecution claim. But
your theory is there's no probable cause to arrest at all.
And he was lying about it.
He's lying about it.
Yeah.
But let's just go to the probable cause to arrest.
Yes.
So the victim says, attacker came in, was wearing camouflage shorts, and what type of T-shirt?
Satellite T-shirt.
Light T-shirt and a hat, right?
Right.
And then the officer comes to the scene of the crime a few minutes later and sees the plaintiff with camouflage shorts, a dark T-shirt, walking a dog, and has the same type of hat.
I would add one thing to that factual scenario. As the very able state judge said, and one of the witnesses, Thomas Troxell, said, the camouflage shorts are the end thing that are virtually a uniform.
Okay.
So everybody's in camouflage shorts at this time in this small town. A lot of them are hunters. And on a late August night, that's why you're walking your dog, because it's hot and humid.
Okay.
So
I understand all those arguments, and I can understand the criminal judge's reaction to this not being proof beyond a reasonable doubt. But my question is, if probable cause is determined on a common sense evaluation of the totality of the circumstances that an arresting officer had that night, why wouldn't that be probable cause?
Because of the time difference.
Because of the
Time. To circle those blocks.
Okay.
Block. If
because he's lying about the time.
Well, if he sees, goes to talk to Troxell, who had five bypass surgeries, and he said was running towards him, and Troxell says, I can't run. And if he sees Troxell, and a few moments later, as he told the state's assistant state's attorney, Luckman, and Luckman said within 2 minutes, looks down that alley and sees Fleming, okay, that's probably probable cause. That's not what happened. It's indisputably not what happened by his own testimony. He went, saw Troxell. According to Turner, he went and interviewed Haley. Then he went back down South Street, got in his car, went up Main Street looking for the person who ran away, then down by the grain elevators. And lo and behold, he stops at Fleming's house, on the second house on the right on Jackson, up from South Street and the Troxells, and sees, he says, walking down the alley, Fleming and the dog, which he cannot see. You look at,
well, you say he cannot see. I understand that argument, but the officer said he could see that.
That's why we have juries.
That's right. That's why we have juries.
Yeah.
If that were a criminal trial, I can see how you could acquit Mr. Fleming, and that's what happened. It happened even before a jury trial. But what I want to know is, why isn't that probable cause? Why isn't that the type of police work that the court would say is probable cause to arrest, to just take him into custody? And we're leaving out an important intervening thing, which is the officer then calls up an assistant state's attorney.
Well, he also lies to the assistant state's attorney undisputedly about the time factor. If he tells him there's 6 minutes and 50 seconds, the state's attorney isn't going to say you got probable cause.
You also had a show up, and she said, yeah, that's him.
Well, as the state judge says, I mean, they identified cargo shorts. What can I do with that? I mean, they saw it, and he was in front of a car.
How do we know that the state's attorney would have said no probable cause?
Well, because he himself said it was the time factor, because he saw him right away. That's what Luckman said in his testimony. So,
but did he go on to say, and if I knew it was 6 minutes versus 2 minutes, I would have not found probable cause? Is that in the record?
No, I didn't follow up with that, Judge. I didn't think it necessary once he says the determinative factor was the 2 minutes. I mean, I don't think, what else do I have to prove? I mean, that seems to me to be obvious. But what we have again here is, I don't see the distinction between a criminal trial you can acquit or a motion to suppress hearing and a Section 1983 case, where what you're doing and you put to me is you're assuming that the officer's telling the truth.
All right. You're into your rebuttal time.
I'm sorry.
All
Thank
right.
You.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Condon.
May it please the court, counsel. Initially, I would submit that the district court actually erred on the probable cause determination, and that this court can reverse that decision before I even get to the qualified immunity analysis. What we have here is a situation where Deputy Turner is doing routine patrol at 1:15 in the morning in a very small rural town near Pontiac, Illinois. He's approached by Mr. Troxell, who said, "Someone just broke into my house and fondled my two daughters." Deputy Turner goes back, goes right to the residence, talks to the girls, and Haley Troxell says that the assailant was wearing camo cargo shorts and a dark baseball cap. Says it was a white male of average height and weight. Deputy Turner goes out, begins to do a search, and he comes across what we later find out is Mr. Fleming's mobile home. And there's
But she also said dark shirt, right?
Well, it's interesting. She, in her deposition 4 years after this incident, for the first time said dark shirt. In the record, she gave an affidavit, and she simply said a shirt. Deputy Turner, in his police report and in his deposition, said she didn't identify if it was a dark or a light T-shirt. It was just a shirt. What's not in the record is Haley also gave a written statement shortly after this incident at the police station and described the man as wearing camo cargo shorts and a dark baseball cap. Said nothing about a color of a T-shirt. So Deputy Turner now sees the light on in what we later find out is Mr. Fleming's mobile home. And he hears the dogs barking. This is the only light that's on in any of these small little homes in Flanagan, Illinois, that's got a population of 1,000 people. He goes and knocks on the door, gets no answer. He starts to leave the residence, and he sees Mr. Fleming walking down the alley. Now, Mr. Cook, who is the expert that plaintiff hired to go out and do these time calculations, he takes issue that Deputy Turner could not have seen Mr. Fleming from where he was standing on the porch. Deputy Turner never said he was standing on the porch when he saw Mr. Fleming. He said he was leaving the residence. He knocked on the door, he went to get back into his car, and he saw down the alley, which you clearly can do.
The car's lights on, car running?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Are the lights of the car on?
On the squad car? I don't know, Your Honor. I don't recall that, no. So in any event, he immediately goes, approaches Mr. Fleming, and there is a man of a white male, average height and weight, wearing camo cargo shorts and a dark baseball cap. There is nobody else out in the town of Flanagan at 1 o'clock in the morning other than Deputy Turner and Mr. Fleming and the Troxels, who got woken up by the suspect who came into their home.
So this issue of everybody wearing those camouflage shorts in the town is irrelevant, given the timing. Is that your position?
Yes, Your Honor. It is. And it's not as if this was the city of Chicago with a population of millions of people. This is a small little town where there's nothing going on at 1 o'clock in the morning. And the only one that's out is Mr. Fleming, and he's got camo cargo shorts on and a dark baseball cap. I would submit to this court that that indeed is probable cause to arrest.
When did the arrest exactly take place? Was it before or after the ASA's call?
It was after, Your Honor.
So if it was after that discrepancy, Counsel Hanks has had a lot on this 2 minutes versus 7 minutes. Is it relevant?
It's not relevant because Deputy Turner testified that he had made the determination that there was probable cause for arrest, and he detained Mr. Fleming. But department policy required him to contact the assistant state's attorney, which he did. He provided the facts as Haley Troxell had given him. He provided them to the state's attorney, and the state's attorney agreed and said, yes, there's probable cause.
So he really didn't affect the arrest till after he got the okay from the assistant state's attorney?
Yes, but his testimony is clear that he believed he had probable cause and was going to arrest him. But I think that his conduct, Deputy Turner's conduct in contacting the state's attorney, goes also to the reasonableness of his conduct that night, which is what the probable cause determination is about, and also under the qualified immunity analysis. In this court's decision in Humphrey, where this court determined that the officer was entitled to probable qualified immunity, the court talked about the concept of arguable probable cause. And at the very least, that's what we have here. Arguable probable cause protects an officer even if his belief that there was probable cause is a mistaken belief. Deputy Turner, this wasn't an officer that went out looking to arrest Mr. Fleming that night. He's at 1 o'clock in the morning in this quiet little town. He's got a man running at him saying, my daughters were just molested. He runs, goes over there, and Haley describes camo cargo shorts and a dark baseball cap. Lo and behold, there's Mr. Fleming within minutes, whether it's that's a red herring, whether it's 2 or 3 minutes or it's 6 minutes. You know, he gets this expert, which he never disclosed, and provides his opinions, which we never had an opportunity to cross-examine. He provides them after discovery is closed and after summary judgment has already been filed by
us. That's the affidavit that Judge McDade struck.
That's right.
But nevertheless tended to consider in his opinion.
That's correct,
but
Judge Castillo.
I want to go back to what's there on the record about why the deputy called the assistant state's attorney?
In the record, the deputy testified that the sheriff's department mm-hmm. had a policy mm-hmm. that the officer should call the on-call state's attorney mm-hmm. to get an opinion as to whether probable cause exists mm-hmm. or not.
And isn't there also in the record that the state's attorney says he wasn't aware of that policy?
The state's attorney said he wasn't aware of the policy, mm-hmm. but there's nothing.
What do you make of that?
Well, I make it that it's two different agencies in mm-hmm. a small rural county, mm-hmm. and I think phone calls and conversations get had all the time.
Mm-hmm. And do you think, while we're on the subject of the state's attorney's testimony, that he relied on this two-minute time frame as being important to probable cause existing?
I think that's a red herring. I think what he relied on is the short interval, not mm-hmm. that it was two. Turner said it was 2 to 3 minutes, mm-hmm. if you look in his deposition. Mm-hmm. Even this expert, you know, mm-hmm. who gave the affidavit, he says it was 6 minutes on his approximation, six mm-hmm. minutes and some change. Well, what if it was 4 minutes? I mean, this testimony would be given 4 years after this incident happened. Oh, I'm going to say it was 6 minutes. He couldn't have come in 3 minutes. There's no dispute that within a very short period of time from when Mr. Troxell approaches Deputy Turner, that Deputy Turner comes upon Mr. Fleming, who's wearing the clothing that matches the description that was given by Haley. And under the qualified immunity analysis, Deputy Turner is entitled to qualified immunity even if his belief that there was probable cause was a mistaken one. As you indicated earlier, Judge Williams, his conduct was not egregious. His determination that there was probable cause in this case wasn't egregious, which is what the Humphrey case and Stasek and those other cases that this court has decided under a qualified immunity analysis. That's what has to be shown. The burden is on the plaintiff to disprove the qualified immunity analysis.
So you would agree that if he was able to prove he was lying, that could be egregious?
Absolutely. But he keeps saying this indisputable, counsel, with all due respect, keeps saying that this indisputable evidence that Deputy Turner was lying, what evidence that he was lying? There's no evidence that he was lying. He's got this expert that he brings in 4 years later who does time calculations to try to show he's lying. Well, we never got a chance to cross-examine him on that. And even if there's a minute discrepancy between what Turner said and what the expert says, I mean, that determines that he's lying? So I don't think there is any evidence in the record that he's lying. But I would submit, Your Honor, that if that was the issue in the case, then of course. Unless Your Honors have any further questions, I would stand on our brief.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Connolly.
Thank you.
Mr. Siegel, how much time? 1 minute.
Well, it's all a matter of interpretation. You look at the photographs. We've got various versions. Harmon Cook isn't an expert. He's a private investigator. And the disclosure element is I offered an interview or he could have taken his deposition. I couldn't calculate the speed because of this four-block area. So I just had somebody do it. The plaintiff was with him who was disclosed. I mean, if the Dirksen Federal Building's an issue and we're getting ready, that's the problem with summary judgment. You get these, you frame the issues and your exhibits aren't ready and things show up that you would not have with trial. Some districts do have pretrial orders where you get that worked out. I mean, this guy just went and did a test. He's not an expert. And you look at these photographs that are at SA5, a jury could say he couldn't see. And the time difference, they could say he's lying. I dispute, and a lot of these cases take the presumption that police officers don't lie. Now, I'm not saying he's lying. I'm saying a jury could find he's lying.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your fine arguments and your briefs. We'll take the case under advisement. Call the next case.